Good morning to all. It's working now. If you didn't know Pastor Yancey and you looked at the display here, you'd say, we have a scholar in our midst. But since you do know Pastor Yancey, you know he's a pastor scholar, which I think is the best kind of pastor to have a theologian in residence among us. He is going to talk this morning about what was actually the subject of his PhD dissertation in 1986, I think it was, on James Cone. So we welcome you to our forum.
Good to be here. Am I heard? Well, the introduction is interesting and apt in that when I was trained, the vision of at least my two teachers, Bob Bertram and Ed Schrader, was to create a whole cadre of pastor theologians. So there were a chunk of folks. Martine Raffanon was one. Michael Hoy, you can raise your hand, is another. And who were trained in the discipline and to get an academic degree, but with a view toward ending up in the church. The way I want to start out today is reading a quote from James Cone's, I guess, last theological book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree. It came out in 2011. This is the very last paragraph of the book. In some ways, it's the last thing he wrote, although he did write a kind of autobiography retrospective just before he died, which was in April of 2018. So I thought we would read this over to begin, and then I'll meander around with the rest. But the lynching tree is a metaphor for white Americans' crucifixion of black people. It is the window that best reveals the religious meaning of the cross in our land. In this sense, black people are Christ figures, not because they wanted to suffer, but because they had no choice. Just as Jesus had no choice in his journey to Calvary, so black people had no choice about being lynched. The evil forces of the Roman state and of white supremacy in America willed it. Yet God took the evil of the cross and the lynching tree and transformed them both into the triumphant beauty of the divine. If America has the courage to confront the great sin and ongoing legacy of white supremacy with repentance and reparation, there is hope beyond tragedy. As I said, this is kind of a capstone of Cone's theology, him looking back and putting in the last theological paragraph that he wrote, some of his main ideas. One, I want to say that I agree with and is something for us to think about currently is that spiritual realities are played out in history. So Cone says the lynching tree is a metaphor for white America's crucifixion of black people. So it's a representation, if you will, of the cross of Christ. And it's the reason that he would often say that Christ or Jesus is black. In our context, I think that's true. And it is true because if you agree that of all the folks, and you don't even have to say of all the folks, we could do some similar identification with the oppression of Native Americans or of women, but clearly in our society, black oppression is, I was going to say a fundamental, I hate using that word, but in some ways it's accurate. It's, in a sense, the fundament upon which our nation sadly rests, even though that's not our best angels. It's not our hope. That's not our Constitution. As many folks say, what it is our original sin. Spiritual realities get played out in history. So there are a number of theologians that say Cone is the most important theologian of our time. He was born in 38. He died in April. He was 80 years old. He spent 50 years of his life teaching at Union Seminary in New York. And he really kind of came of age as a theologian in the late 60s and early 70s when Black Power was coming to the fore. And so he was a guy who was trained very classically in European, white, and Western theology. But when the Black Power movement arrived, he was extremely affected by it, obviously as a black man. But I think in his own life, he felt a kind of contradiction of, I'm trained. I know he wrote a dissertation on Karl Barth, the great Swiss theologian of the early 20th century. He knew Paul Tillich's theology very well, and as you read a lot of his stuff, it's really shot through with a very deep understanding of white European theology. But I think he felt internally that there's a contradiction here. And not only that, he felt from his own experience. And his theology, and maybe that's a good way to express it, his theology went from, shall we say, theoretical and doctrinal to experiential. And he drew on his own experience of growing up in the southern part of Arkansas. Fordyce and Bearden are about 50 miles from the Louisiana border, due south of Little Rock. And as he tells his own experience, I don't know how many, whether he viewed lynchings himself, but he does talk about coming home often and being just absolutely afraid, happy to see his father, that his father was still there and still alive. Bearden was maybe 1,200 people, 800 whites, 400 blacks. So it was a real mix of folks, but it was clear what the power structure was and what the demeaning of life was and how you fit in, and that it was very fragile. And so that was Cone's own experience of a challenge to his and his. And I think he felt very deeply for his parents as well. I think as we all would, if we see our parents who are struggling, shall we say, we have a heart for them. So that was a prominent experience. And then some of us remember and experience the riots in the various cities, Chicago being one, but Cone was living in Detroit when that started burning in the late 60s. And really it just, and the emergence of Black Power movement just struck him very deeply that he had to speak out of his experience, of the experience of the black community. And the more he did, I think the deeper his analysis came. In a number of the early books, you actually don't ever hear him speak about lynching as the fundamental metaphor. He talks always about Jesus being black for our society and our world. But he kind of, and it's interesting that just recently, what's the memorial in Montgomery now? I forget the name of it, which is, pardon?
Are you talking about the lynching?
Yes, I am talking about that. So it's, that reality is, as shall we say, a truth of American society is coming from, bubbling up in a lot of places, even though, and I think maybe it was suppressed for so long because it is so brutal. Valerie and I were just, well, if you read Cone's book or you read anybody's book about the actual fact of lynching, you can hardly read it. Or if you see pictures, we were in Louisville a few years ago doing a wedding, and of course we went to, was Hillerick and Bradby, where they make baseball bats. I did that. But we also were in a Black History Museum where they had reproduced a number of newspaper articles from the 30s, 40s, where these were almost like celebrations. People gathered around for the killing of another human being. It's so, for folks to say Cone is the most important theologian of our time is to suggest that the original sin of our time is racism and slavery. I read a little note. These are historians, a couple of folks named Elizabeth Fox Genovese and Eugene Genovese, historians. They write, "Americans have with reason long brooded over slavery as if it were our own national equivalent of original sin. For slavery rent the world's most noble republic and disgraced the world's most promising democracy. It precipitated a war, often literally, though not metaphorically, fratricidal, that proved ghastly in itself and terrifying in its implications for the future of humanity. And it left a legacy of racism that has brought mortification and unremitting agony to Southerners and Northerners, whites and blacks." One of the things Cone is clear to make prominent in his theology is that in some ways he's very aggressive about, "I'm speaking to the black community and to hell with," which he says fairly often with white theology and other folks. But it is also clear that he understands that coming to grips with our original sin will work toward the betterment of our society and the forgiveness of us as human beings and the fulfillment or the filling out of us in our humanity. And feel free at any time.
With whom did he quarrel, and with whom did he quarrel in the black community, the leaders?
Well,
was there a strong identification?
I think because he was, I mean, the man remained an academic his entire life. 50 years he taught at Union Seminary in at least arguably the most prominent progressive or liberal seminary in the country, and a very prestigious place to be. And I think by his own admission and under self-understanding, I don't think he was particularly an activist. I think he admired two folks very much, you might imagine, Martin King and Malcolm X. But he himself, as far as, I don't know, he may have been more on the front lines of things than I think. But he's often accused of being too much of an existentialist theologian in the form of the theology that he learned. He also, well, but and then, but from that's with, I say, within the black community that, in general, I think they respected him, and over the long haul, he had lasting power, and I think the appreciation that he has garnered over this last time is, well, it's from blacks and whites alike. Now, I obviously spent not quite a decade of my life thinking about this, just reread it, and I thought, well, I don't know. Well, it's clearly a white perspective, although it absolutely agrees. And I would say, as a white theologian, I totally agree with Cone, and it has shaped my theology. And my experience of the black community, particularly in Chicago, is as much as anything why I am here today as a pastor. I went from that experience to the seminary. So I think Cone is absolutely right, and Genovese, and those who understand racism and slavery as the sin we have to get over. And if we reflect today, have we gotten over it? No. Our politics are shot through with it. And I would say categorically that one of our major political parties uses the dog whistle of racism and slavery every single damn election.
What do you mean, day?
Pardon?
Every day.
So, what do I mean by that? That white supremacy is encouraged and lifted up for what I'll say. This is a common example, but I'm going to use it again in my sermon about the Charlotte incident of. You know, there's truth on both sides. There's this kind of false equivalency of that justifies and lifts up and regularizes hatred and no, I think the Democratic Party, when they bit the bullet on civil rights, they sucked up said, we know this is going to kill us, and it has. But they did at least say our problem is here. I think, and I don't think that the Democratic Party or progressives or independents are going to talk Republicans into doing that, but I do think that they have to come to a true reality. And I think the critique within lots of conservative folks that I read and respect highly. So I don't think this is just, you could say, red and blue, which that's another part of my sermon earlier. It gives a sense of the dichotomy, but it's not that simple. And there are great numbers of conservative folks that understand this reality and are calling for some kind of acknowledgement of it.
Wasn't there a faith perspective by a professor at the seminary this week? Saying, anybody see that in the Post-Dispatch was
from Concordia, saying, actually.
Yeah, a professor from Concordia.
Yeah.
The faith perspective. Did you see it?
I did see that.
Saying that just, you know, God, tell me if I got this right.
If God
uses a bad person to do good things.
Pardon?
God uses a Napa River.
Cyrus, was it?
I can't remember the details, but it was.
I think it was Cyrus.
If good things come out of God, out of a bad person.
Yeah.
Like some people hold up Trump saying, like, he's accomplishing. We don't care what his morals are, but he's doing the right thing for us.
Yeah. Well, and right. And that's a good. You hear that day in and day out from very bright and committed folks who say, well, we set this, his language, his words aside, which, now can you do that? Now, to me, reality flows from your language. You're only able to do certain things because you set a linguistic world that we live in, and for folks to deny that I have heard many folks do that, and that's the way they'll often say, well, yeah, we just set what he says aside because we like the tax deal. We like, maybe we think immigration needs to be addressed, which it does. Yes, Paul.
What does he mean, or what do you think? I try to disrupt the ways to do systematic theology.
Yeah, we could flip down to the... Oh, I just one more personal story about the persistence and of this problem and the denial of it. When I was writing my dissertation, we had an event. It wasn't for me. Ed Schrader used to have. He called them CNOs, cherry and olive. You can figure what that. He would bring in theologians and invite whoever. Maybe some of you have been to those events. But I was at one, and I'll leave out the name, but a very prominent systematic theologian who is a close and good friend of Ed Schrader and the late Bob Bertram, and I were sitting next to one another, and he asked me what I was doing my dissertation on. I said, you know, James Cone's Black Theology. And he basically, well, he didn't hit the roof, but close. He really dismissed. He said, first of all, he said, the racism issue is done. That's been settled. Yeah. Now this was, yeah, yeah. Would that it were true, right?
Now, context for us, what year?
This would have been mid-80s. My degree was in 86, and you know these things. I was writing it for
7 years.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I got it in. I mean, that was it. It was going to be there or forget it. 86 was, yeah. You got to have a deadline, right? So this would have been probably, might have been 86 or 85, but the mid-80s. So Cone was dismissed as kind of irrelevant as a theologian. But perhaps more astoundingly, that this person thought that essentially the problem of racism had pretty much been solved. But I think that kind of attitude still persists in a lot of folks, I mean, who challenge equal rights, opportunity things. Yeah, it's the same deal with, the universities getting sued over stuff about women. And, you know, has it all straightened out? I don't think so. But
In the new Jim Crow, the reference was that we have all become somewhat colorblind, but we haven't addressed still the deep issues of racism yet. I think that's one of the issues they raise in that we may have come to a point in our context and culture that we could move beyond issues of seeing different people of different color and not having an issue with that. But we still haven't addressed the deep issues of white supremacy and white privilege.
Yeah, and what does he say here? The original sin of the white society is white supremacy, is what he is saying. I'll say on the backside of that, in his understanding, and why he's so vocal in his theology and in his public speak. I heard him speak once. I don't recall that he was that much of a firebrand as one of the Northside Black churches about that same era. But his understanding of what he calls black original sin is the self-hatred that is accepted. But there's this huge lead up to it of 400 years of in my book and many analysis, when we think of people who are taken from homeland, losing history, family, who are refused any kind of education, who are commodified and moved around the South at any rate as just instrumental goods. They were even refused, for the most part, decent burials that would... So it's like life is stolen, history is stolen, education is foreclosed. You don't even your death is taken away. It's as totally commodified. And then in the context of just personal safety, like Cone felt with respect to his father coming home, you can see how folks kind of would, believing the lie that the oppressor projects as truth. And in my dissertation, what I tried to say is, you know, from more of an existentialist perspective, is that white society, white theology, or white society in particular, in response to our fear of death, try to lay that upon another people, externalize it outside of ourselves. And that's historically then what we do. And when that's accepted, but at any rate, so Cone is just very passionate about speaking against that thing, and then very passionate, obviously, of speaking for his people. And I think, in a way, you can almost hear him say that he was posturing some. But is it a righteous anger? You know, I'm not really terribly big on the notion of wrath and the wrath of God. Although Cone would say, if you're not going to be angry about this, you know, what are you going to be angry about? So, and I think he really felt that he needed. His experience in the halls of academe were, and he got along with Reinhold Niebuhr and Tillich and lots of these really great theologians, and had healthy conversations with him. But what he says is, the other original sin of whites, no passion. And in a way, he says we have to be passionate. I mean, in a sense, it recalls and calls up the passion of Christ. That we're fighting for our lives here, and so he's very, very passionate about his theology, and he makes no bones about what he thinks about theology's purpose. He says liberation is the gospel. I had to think about that for a while. Well, growing up, as we have, we think of what is salvation? We don't think of it generally in historically liberating terms. I'm willing to be challenged on that if that's not what you think, but that's kind of the way I think. I grew up with stuff. Valerie and I were talking this morning. Even though Luther actually developed his theology out of his experience, it was a personal experience. And he was challenging the church as kind of the devil. And he said some pretty disruptive things. Yes, that's right. But Cone's critique, particularly of Luther, is that he just totally missed the systemic reality of sinfulness. Although I think he saw it in the church, he didn't carry that over into society at large. And was he on the right side of history or not when peasants' revolts and things like that started happening? Well, Luther's pretty conservative guy in terms of polity. And he just, well, he's probably open for criticism. I think what, you know, we can talk about this later on, but I do think what somebody like Cohn and our current reality lead us to, and I understand that perhaps we talked about in the general forum here, should we become more of an activist church? That was really the topic, in a way, the topic of our retreat, too, in Carlinville. Given the truth of what we see, are we called to be more than... I wrestle around with that. I have to say, in a lot of ways, I feel like a little bit like Cohn, in the sense of, you know, a lot of this I live in my head. I'm not a great activist. Moderately so, but I think a lot of that is how we've been brought up. Are we being challenged by Cohn and the reality that we experience these days, Bread for the World and others, and you know, folks like Jim who are more out on the front lines of these problems of race and so forth. I'm glad you brought up the Jim Crow stuff. And, you know, please. I'd like to respond.
I hope I'm not going off the rails here. I have three streams of thought. One is, regarding the other side on these issues, one thing I battle against is I'm almost Pavlovian in my response to these people. And I don't want to become guilty of what they're like.
Yeah, yeah.
So I try to, and when I'm around people that we're all in complete agreement, I almost get a headache because, you know, I agree with the passion, but I'm afraid I'm going to become like the people I don't want to be, you know, just, you know. Mm. And I've actually tried to think of some things good about Trump, and I'm still working on it. So the other thing is, as you mentioned, Luther at the National Genocide Museum in Kigali. As you walk in, it's a wing that's just about genocide in the world, and everything from the Holocaust to Pol Pot and the Armenian. And as you walk in there, there's a quote, and it says, the Jews, I'm going to paraphrase, the Jews must be eradicated by water and fire, whatever means necessary, they must be getting rid of. And it's by Martin Luther. And that's the first quote you see as you walk into the Genocide Museum.
Ouch.
So, yeah. Which made me think about the issue of does God have bad people do good things? And I hope so, or I'm in trouble. And I guess the third thing, real quickly, is, you know, in Rwanda, black Hutus massacred black Tutsis mm-hmm. by the hundreds of thousands. And in Tanzania, black Maasai are being marginalized and losing their land. And the analogy between this people and the first Americans, Native Americans, is chilling, and it's people with the same skin color. So it's depressing.
Well, it brings up a good point that Cohn makes a lot. Our theology is contextual. So yeah, it's in those situations, there's a black on black reality that they got to figure out. Ours, we know what our historical reality, but that's a very excellent point. And you know, I mean, I'll say it again in my, I'm previewing in my sermon enough. You won't have to come up. You know, I'm gonna nail the current administration because I think there's some, you know, very important and powerful things, but we always have to say, you know, whether it's by silence or slow action or inaction or we don't believe things, or we have to look at our own reality. It's not just we, you know, shaking our fist at something obvious that probably needs to, for that to happen, but we have to, in that context, say, well, you know, and deep down, finally, you got to deal with forgiveness, too. You know that. Yes, Gail.
Well, Brenda's first.
Brenda first.
In what ways did Cohen address the intersection between race and gender?
Ah.
Did he look at the experiences of black women, for example?
Black women kicked his butt. In the last book he wrote, he's got a very good chapter on womanist theology. I think as a product of his age, he missed it early on and got called on it. And said, yeah,
so
I'm wrong.
Did other people say that sexism was an original sin?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sure some folks have.
Very daily.
Yeah, Luther, yeah. For example. And she was in his time. So I'm just, it is interesting how we pick, there's an identity that's especially strong for each of us, maybe two or three, and that's what we're able to focus on. And it's that intersection, I think, now that becomes so important in contemporary, the world, not just the United States.
Yeah, I think in his later work and his later thought, this book, he has a chat that's really is trying to bring this together. And I think he would argue, and I probably would as well, is that but do we need to argue about what is the fundamental metaphor?
Of course not.
We probably don't.
I'm just arguing that there is.
No, I know you're not.
Arguing, but I'm suggesting that from my perspective, to talk about it as the original sin, I'm not sure that's so helpful.
Okay.
That it's helpful to look at all of the original sins that come out of power relations.
Well, Jim Wallace says, if you identify this, then Cohen's the most important theologian. I think we say, you know, he has identified a very powerful dynamic in our society, but it then should also speak to all these others. Personally, worldwide, I would say, now this is me, that misogyny is the fundamental original sin.
Yeah. Yeah.
But,
and I don't know, because there's colorism around the world that's a little different than racism.
To tidy that, or my own thought up, one more about that. I think Cohen, particularly at the end of his career, was trying to be expansive in his embrace of this is a notable and significant metaphor that tells us and should inform us about all other issues of oppression. And I think this is his best book, called God of the Oppressed. It's his third one. It's really after he's kind of maybe dialed. Yeah, it's a little later. He's dialed back a bit of rhetoric, and it's really he puts. He still has passion, but he puts together just kind of the history and the theology together probably best in this. Yes, Ruth.
So I think this image of original sin is actually a really powerful one. I sort of had a similar reaction when Ferguson arose, to really reflect on, yes, how ingrained it is in all kinds of areas. I agree with the point that it's perhaps any form of oppression or presumption of supremacy. But I guess that what is he saying our call is to do about that? Then where does that take us? First of all, is that the recognition of the sin, I guess repentance of that, but then what is our, you know, where do we go from
mm-hmm.
there?
I would say that in my reading of him, I don't recall or I can't identify programmatically what he says needs to be done. He fights within his theological community to say, here is one way that we need to change things, and our mindsets theologically and so forth, that will be a help. And he does say, this is where I'm fighting. But he does, however, I think, admire Martin King very much, even though I think violence, nonviolence is, he's kind of maybe on the edge. But in the end, I think he would be a kind of a nonviolent person. But he's worried that
in his early works, I'd say he tips more to Malcolm X than Martin Luther King, I would say.
In his early, did you say? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. As you read him later on, I think you see him really, in a sense, I was going to say redeeming or embracing King a lot more than he did early on. Yeah, and this, his first two books really were kind of kick out the jams books, and in some ways were meant to be shocking, but they were thoughtful. And they were again reactions to events like the assassination, like the burning of the cities, and just his own experience of being, shall we say, messed with. But yeah, in Black Theology of Liberation, I tried to capture the funk of Black people as they expressed it using Malcolm X. Improvisational militant style, a don't mess with me attitude. Now there's a line in there, you say we need to do it by ever means to achieve liberation. And if a few honkies die along the way, so be it. And I go, oh. he dialed that back. I think he was being, well, personally, I think he was being provocative, but, and I don't know of any action that he ever promoted that was physically violent toward anyone. Gail?
Okay. So I want to know where the Lutheran Church is in this sort of span of time. because, this is my grandfather's history. My grandfather did inner city Black congregations.
Yeah, yeah.
And even as a kid, I was painfully aware that this was imposing white tradition on Black inner city congregations. I mean, I was 16 maybe when he retired, so I mean, I was really aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
So what took the Lutheran Church into these inner city congregations? I mean, this was inner city Baltimore, and Detroit, these were scary places. The kind of place where, my grandmother locked us in our bedrooms at night. We were not allowed to leave. You could not go to the bathroom in the night. But it somehow felt wrong to me. That's all I can say.
Is the overlaying.
It wasn't in any way accommodating to the community that he served.
Mm-hmm.
It was hymns, we're starting at 8 o'clock, and it's 8 o'clock we're starting, and it doesn't matter if the congregation doesn't show up till 8:45. And
so is this a theological colonialism?
Maybe that's the way to talk about it. Anyway, it was just always very troubling to me. But I have to say, they did amazing outreach within the community outside of the actual event of church.
I'm going to get in a chunk of my lecture that I want to make sure happens. You're reminding me of it, namely Cohn's. But I will get back to your question too. Cone's third book, in some ways, yeah, some of his most powerful stuff, it's on the spirituals and the blues. And part of his proclamation and realization was just after having the experience of everything being stolen, you know, community, education, future, hope, death. What are you going to say? You're going to sing the blues. You're going to sing the spirituals. But these were profoundly, profoundly deep expressions, theological, existential expressions of there's more to us. And you can really see and get a feel for the power of the Black Church, and that the passionate songs, spirituals, that kind of told the truth, that actually reconstituted a community of people. And so I'm just remembering the Black Church part of it, how, although, you know, he knows the critique there too about, you know, sometimes it's just, you just go along to get along, but I think Cone is saying that the spirituals, the blues, and the Black Church really saved the Black community and its history. And I'm just going to quickly, did anybody hear yesterday on NPR a piece on Dvorak? Did you? New World Symphony, inspired and incorporated from Black spirituals. Dvorak comes over from wherever and says, the authentic reality here of new music, new world, and new world music is the Black spirituals.
I put that music on my Christmas list.
You should. Well, you know, the second movement is called Largo, which a hymn was written from it, going home. I was listening to Largo when I learned Kristen died going home. I was in Chautauqua. I'll never forget that music. I mean, I was transformed by it as I was listening. But at that moment, I heard that Kristen Tunis went home. I just mentioned this again to kind of underscore and underline the power of the Black spiritual. Swing Low, I think, was New World of Music was inspired and modified from that spiritual. Yeah, Barry.
I want to respond to Gail's comment. I was a young seminarian and worked in the inner city of Detroit during the early race riots. And
oh, you were in Detroit.
I was in Detroit the whole time, and it was in the Brewster Douglas projects. And the Lutheran Church did what it thought it should do. It was well-intentioned, but they had no idea for what they were going to do. And I remember a quote from Daniel Berrigan when he said about the church and the civil rights movement. He said, "The church always arrives on the scene a little late and a little breathless."
And a little late and a little?
Breathless.
Breathless, okay.
I remember when I got to the seminary, they still had this mentality, and they did what I said was the deepest racist thing that the seminary ever did. Kemmerer wouldn't talk to me for months because I was on the academic policies committee as a student. Mm-hmm. And what they put into play is what they called the Black Churchman's Program, which absolved Black seminarians of taking any foreign languages, taking Greek and Hebrew. And I said, what you're going to do is forever make these pastors second-class citizens because you don't believe they can do the curriculum like white people can. And I said, if you feel that way, get them tutors, extend their time, but don't do this. I said that, I was like kind of thought of like persona non grata for a while.
Yeah.
And they did it anyway. That was 1970, 71.
That's a good story in the context of thinking about Cohn, because he had to get tuned up a bit, and there were a lot of people that didn't want to. He got his PhD from Northwestern. He got his MDiv from Garrett Seminary, which is in Chicago. There were folks, maybe you shouldn't even be here, but he did have white advocates that encouraged him, and so he had that challenge, but there were enough people who said, you will learn this stuff, and we'll stick with you to make sure you do. Yes, Valerie. Yes.
You wouldn't hear that at all in a traditional European. So there are some fundamental differences between action and doctrine, and between individual piety, salvation, and understanding sin as a social. And then you also said to me, James Cohn said that blackness is not skin color. And maybe that gets to a little of what Dan was saying.
Yeah, that's good, yeah.
It's
spirit.
It's spirit.
Yeah.
And power and social dynamics, which would then include women in Latin American liberation theologians and LGBT liberate. I was just thinking about emotional intelligence and doing some reading, and there is evidence that humans have a limited capacity. We have a capacity for empathy, but it's pretty short lived. Really move into the lived experience of being a woman in a sexist culture or being black in a racist culture, we can sort of get it intellectually, but our capacity is always, our impulses to live our own experience and what makes it work. So this inborn tendency we have to not deeply be able to empathize, that's why women started doing. We didn't want white male Europeans telling us what we ought to believe about our salvation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
same kind of experience.
And
yeah.
So it does sort of transcend just skin color.
Yes. Now he's very clear about that. Even though he's clearly historically urgent to. Yeah, Paul.
When you mentioned the word salvation, we have kind of an evacuation theology that brings us out of this world to another world. And
yeah.
It seems to me that Cohn probably didn't have that kind of evacuation mentality, nor do black theologians generally. Unless the blues is one of the ways to give us patience until we're gone.
You know, he does have a whole section on heaven. But I think he says that, and in a way it's like the future, the hope for the future breaking in. I mean, the vision of a decent community then inspires and energizes for here. So I do think Cohn recognizes that can.
Well, I was thinking about the Lutheran Church in the black community.
Yeah.
Gail was talking about. Yeah. What in the world for? Right. So Luther, he was catechism, all that stuff, right? Why?
Yeah. I'll just a little more autobiography. Maybe it's, again, it's what I brought to the seminary, and maybe I will say I wrote a paper about James Cone or about his theology. It got back to him, and it was encouraged, and it really it's why I kind of moved along. I did send him my dissertation one time. Never heard back, so I don't know. Reading it, I kind of understand maybe why. And, because it... But when I spent 4 years in Chicago working for a church operation, but which eventually got booted for sure, Walt Reiner and the Prince of Peace Volunteers...
which is what my grandfather...
Did he? Yeah. Well, that's right, folks. Can't, yeah. It was more than most situations a willingness to work within the context of those communities. Now we weren't doing church services. I mean, we were doing other stuff, and we were at the direction of folks, and so there were I would say a few that were kind of trying to break that mold, that model. But
no, I mean, I do think that the work that my grandfather's churches did, you had to separate two things. Mm-hmm. They ran a daycare center, they had a healthcare mm-hmm. center. They did some really, really good things. It was the planting yeah. of the church idea that I knew
yeah.
was
yeah.
problematic. Not the volunteer work that people did in those communities was probably essential to bringing back those communities to some extent. And you know, this was from St. Philip's in about 1950 to Detroit in 56 to Baltimore probably in 65. So a pretty disruptive time in yep. our history. So yeah, no, I think the Prince of Peace Volunteers that he had did really good things. It was the church part.
Well, in a way, it's still our challenge, I guess. And as denominations shrink, maybe that's part of the reason. And then as we maybe are informed by folks like Cone or Elizabeth Fiorenza Schussler or the liberationists in Gutierrez and others in the South, are we called to rethink? What I did in the dissertation was maybe kind of a halfway step. I really placed Cone. I said, how can Cone work within a law gospel context? And it was pretty bright, but I don't know that it was got to say, you know, I'm saying different things these days. Kevin.
The discussion I'm hearing is, as you say, in your grandfather's era. So let me bring it to this era, since talking Thanksgiving with my nieces and nephews' children, we're all black. What are they facing? I live in the city of St. Louis. It is essentially 50% white, 50% black. There were 203 murders last year. 190 were black, 12 white, 1 Hispanic. At the end of the year, they had a list of 136 suspects. For having committed the murders, 135 out of 136 were black. The world that my niece's and nephew's children are running into is very different than the 1960s. And I look at some of the racial profiling that goes on and think, but this racial profiling isn't going away until the criminality stops. With this much variation. I also, I guess, trying to bring that, also looking at then Serena losing a game in the U.S. Open, Serena Williams, and how there were two different camps with people on each side of it. And as I look at that, what I saw was there's a hermeneutic which is very important for understanding certain things. But when the message, the hermeneutic, the message itself, when the hermeneutic becomes the message itself, we no longer are looking at a truth that we can all share. And what I heard was Billie Jean King and Chris Evert trying to say women are treated different, and Martina Navratilova saying, yeah, but if you look at what actually is happening here, that what the referee did made sense. And there's no way to bring those two together without ultimately saying this is a post-truth alternative fact world. Those are my two threads of thoughts.
Fortunately, I'm out of time.
And sort of a lighter note, if you want to go, there's nothing but Lutherans in Tanzania. If you want to go to a Lutheran church service in this remote village called Lobo Sarit that I go to, you got a spare 3 hours, that is a party. You could see they've got the order of a Lutheran service in there, but it's a sort of a suggestion. I mean, it's just amazing. So, you know, some people have adapted and absorbed it and rejoice with it. Great joy. So,
Barry.
So lately I've been analyzing data that colleagues and I have from survivors of 9/11. And what we were interested in is what religious resources they used when the towers were falling, because we were studying all the agencies in the area. And what's interesting is that the Christians, Catholics and Protestants, turned inward to God. They prayed, they read the Bible, they said psalms. What they didn't do is look and witness the towers falling or any bad things. In contrast, the Jews looked and observed, and many of them felt they needed to be witnesses to evil. But what I'm bringing up is the way Christians handled turmoil. They turned inward, turned to God. The Jews, on the other hand, are out there trying to witness, and they work from a principle which is a long tradition called Tikkun
Olam,
which means, for Jews, doing social justice is doing religious activities. And that's why there's so many Jews involved in social justice, because for them, that is the way that they serve their God.
I'll just say quickly, when I was in Chicago doing all this stuff, I won't say he was my main man, but he was a great Marxist Jew that taught me just these things that you're talking about. I'd be happy to, you know, I never think I'm going to have enough to say, but I probably got through a small portion. But again, yeah, I think we're challenged in our congregation as a Lutheran polity, as the Christian church in general.
To the question that both Valerie and Barry are raising here about, are we being called to, not an inward between me and God kind of deal, but
that's mostly what the Christian church does.
Well, yeah, it is. Well, thank you all.